Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubinstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list, we'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today's guest is a familiar face to millions all over the world as a BBC newsreader and foreign correspondent with a career spanning three decades. He's covered some of the biggest stories of our time, from Hurricane Katrina to the COVID pandemic and 9/11. He's reported from the front lines of conflicts in Africa, the Middle East, and covered wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and most recently, Ukraine. Reporting from the BBC from the roof of a hotel in the capital, Kiev, when the war broke out, a site that many of us will remember. He's the host of Mastermind. Yes, of course, it is Clive Myrie. Clive recently swapped to the BBC studios for sun-drenched Italian countryside with his first travel show, Clive Myrie's Italian Road Trip, a 15-part series which follows Clive as he embarks on a captivating journey around the country, immersing himself in its culture, its rich history and local cuisine, from its heel to its very top. So we, of course, chat about that, as well as his hugely varied career, which has taken him to over 80 countries in itself. Clive recently swapped to the BBC studios for sun-drenched Italian countryside with his first travel show, Clive Myrie's Italian Road Trip, a 15-part series which follows Clive as he embarks on a gorgeous journey around the country, immersing himself in its culture, rich history and local cuisine from the heel right to its top. So we, of course, chat about that, as well as his hugely varied career, which has taken him to over 80 countries in itself. So there's a lot to cover, from Jamaica to Japan, Italy to Washington, D.C., and much more. Let's get started with the travel diaries of Clive Myrie. Clive Myrie, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. Thank you so much for coming here today. How are you?
I am very well, thank you.
It has been, I imagine, a rather busy few days. For listeners listening later on, we have just had the coronation of King Charles here in London. And yeah, what's it been like?
Well, that was intense. Wet, soggy. on the Saturday, the day of the actual crowning, which was a shame. But it meant that something like 2,000 or 3,000 people who were in the bleachers opposite Buckingham Palace, they got absolutely soaked because they weren't allowed to have umbrellas.
They weren't allowed to have umbrellas. I didn't realise that. I guess it would obscure the...
Exactly. Yeah. It would block the views of the people behind. And so they just sat there getting soaked.
That's dedication for
it,
you,
it
isn't
is,
it?
It is. But having said that, I mean, they saw the coach leave Buckingham Palace with all the attendant pageantry and grenadier guards and in their bearskins and whatever around. And then they saw the gold state coach return, yes, with the newly crowned monarchs. So to get a glimpse of that up close must have been, well, it was incredible for me. So I suspect it was probably incredible for the people who sat out there in the rain. And maybe that was enough compensation, I hope, for them. I suppose it also, the day also made you realize actually that it's a weird situation. Golden robes, holy anointing.
Yeah.
You know, the public weren't allowed to see that. It was behind a screen because it's essentially God that's seeing it. That's what the point of that is. So the king and queen, their backs were to the main part of the church. And one hopes that all that surrounding the monarchy, the symbolism and the diamonds and the throne and the crown, that all that ends up in a monarchy that is activist, that does stuff, or else it is just artifice, or else it is just a whole bunch of symbols. And I think someone like Charles has shown throughout his life as Prince of Wales that, you know, He'll get stuck in and he'll make his views count and he will say what he needs to say and, you know, way
because
ahead
of
his time.
Because you've met him, haven't you? You've chatted to him.
I have, yes, I have. And I think that's what you want from a royal family. It's difficult because I think a lot of people are saying, well, if only they were like, they'd be cheaper if they were like the Belgians and they were cheaper if they're like the Dutch royal family. But if you want, if there is a voice of moral clarity on the world stage when it comes to climate change, when it comes to inequity, when it comes to trying to make the world a better place, I suppose. I think there's much more force behind King Charles's voice than perhaps the King of Belgium.
Yeah.
Or Denmark. Or Sweden.
Yeah.
Or even Japan.
I mean, over the decades of your career, you've been on the front line or in the midst of so many kind of pivotal historic events. Like you said, it was incredible. So is it still a pinch me moment when you're up among it? Or do they all kind of blend in, all these crazy major events that you're part of?
It's a good question. You never, and I actually said this while I was broadcasting in a gap while we were on air. You don't actually realize how important these events are and how significant they are, truly, while you're in the middle of them. I did a lot of reporting during the COVID pandemic. And that's a once in a 100-year event.
Yeah.
This was a once in a 70-year event. When I covered the election of Barack Obama and his inauguration, that had never happened before, a black man becoming, an African-American becoming president of the United States. But when you're in the moment, you're sort of focused on your job, which is important, obviously. You're focused on getting it right. And you're busy dealing with detail. Mm. It's only when you're able to step away from all that, that you see the bigger picture.
And reflect on it.
Yeah.
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 That's really interesting. I mean, there are so many parts of your career that I'm looking forward to talking to you about as we journey through your life's travel diaries today, Clive. Mm-hmm. We're going to start actually at the very beginning. Chapter one is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
That would be myself, my younger brother and younger sister flying with my mother back to Jamaica. And this would be about 1974, 1975. So it was the first time my mum was going back after emigrating from Jamaica to Bolton in Lancashire. So it was a big trip for her.
How long was the gap?
Well, she moved to the United Kingdom in 1962. So it was well over a decade.
Wow.
Well over a decade.
And what a contrast, I imagine. I mean, in terms of from moving from there to England and then to go back.
Yeah.
And for you to go there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A real contrast, especially as the majority of the Windrush generation, they saw themselves as coming to the UK for 5-6 years, make a bit of money and get a nest egg together and then move back. The vast majority may have thought that, but the vast majority didn't end up actually doing that. Mm. They ended up staying. Mm-hmm. So it would have been a bittersweet moment for my mum to be going back, excited, seeing everyone again, seeing her parents again, and excited for me and my younger brother and sister seeing the life that they had and getting in touch with our roots.
Yeah.
And all I did was whinge. I mean, what would I have been? I would have been 10, 11, maybe. It was too hot. I was bitten by mosquitoes constantly. Mm. I didn't like the food. Actually, no, that's not true. I did like the food because we had it at home. We had it in Lancashire. But I remember really missing my school friends because it was the summertime and I would have been out playing football in the backyard with my mates and I really, really missed all that. And it was just really, really hot. And I was prone then, still am to a degree actually, to travel sickness, mm-hmm. Even though I spend my time traveling.
On planes?
Less so on planes now, more in cars now, but then it was planes. So I was just sick all the time on that flight from the UK to Kingston in Jamaica. And then there were cross-country journeys along bumpy bush roads to see cousins and other relatives. And so I was just you know, throwing up the whole time there. So, yeah, it was not the most wonderful travel experience, it has to be said.
Is it a place, though, that you have returned to as an adult? And
Under much better circumstances.
Under better circumstances. And during your childhood, I've heard you say before that it was actually really early on that you knew you wanted to be a journalist.
Yeah. I had a paper round as a kid, and I read my own product. You know, I got free copies at the end of the day, and I enjoyed reading what was going on and finding out what was going on in the world. And that was about the same time, actually, sort of, you know, 10, 11, 12. And I found the newspapers and television to be, you know, windows on a wider world that was fascinating to me and interesting and different. And I wanted to sort of explore more of that and hopefully make a career out of that. You know, I've managed to do that a little bit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, moving on to chapter two, and that is the first place that you fell in love with, Clive. Which would you pick for that?
First place I fell in love with, I think it's probably Italy. I love the weather. I love the people. I love the food. And I just found Italians very sort of welcoming and warm. And I love that. And I've been going back ever since. And I love the architecture. I love opera. And it's a place where I've always felt welcome. And a place with people who are very sort of outgoing and gregarious. And in lots of ways, they remind me of people from the Caribbean, actually. Very welcoming and not worried about self. Funnily enough, in a way, Italians are. It's a home of, you know, international fashion. It is a place where people are very conscious of the way they look. But at the same time, they're not that conscious about how they come across. So they're very carefree, very
uninhibited.
Easy. Uninhibited, yes. In a way that I think, and I don't mean to upset the French, in a way that I don't think the French are, in lots of ways.
So your new series, your road trip through Italy, Clive Murray's Italian road trip, to be precise, that then must have been the dream gig.
Yes, in lots of ways. I mean, I'd obviously spent a lot of time in Italy since 1983. And in fact, my wife and I, we go to Verona in the summer for the opera festival every year.
Oh, how gorgeous.
Which is wonderful. And the BBC came to me and said, look, we want to make a travel series. I said, really? And they said, yeah, why not? And I said, okay, where do you want to go? And I said, well, the idea was that Brits were traveling again after COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't been to Verona for two and a half years because of the lockdown. So I said, well, why don't we just go to Italy?
And so you travelled literally throughout Italy. I mean, it was a really extensive journey. Mm. Obviously, as you say, you've been there before, but what was your favourite place that you discovered along the way that you hadn't been to before?
I mean, I spent a lot of time in Puglia, which I'd been to before, but only briefly. And I found that to be wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
I'm hoping to go there in September. So do you have any recommendations as to where I must visit?
Well, I mean, I would certainly go to Matera. Matera is a incredibly old, in fact, I suspect, thought to be one of the oldest human settlements.
Mm.
And it's completely unspoilt.
Yeah.
You don't see much concrete.
No.
You don't see many bricks. It's all, by and large, stone. And it's a place that is magical because it is unspoiled. It doesn't feel like it's been touched visually by modernity. And as a result, that it has, you know, a really special quality.
And you stayed in a cave dwelling there, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's you know, the city built up over time, and the dwellings are made of the stone that's carved out of the rock. That left a lot of holes, caves. And over time, centuries, they were used for storage, animals and wine and so on. But as the town got bigger and bigger, Industrial Revolution and so on, they're running out of space. So people started living in the caves. And some of them are huge, absolutely huge, cavernous. Yeah. People started living in the caves. But in proportion to the people who were living in proper stone dwellings, it wasn't very high. You then had the Second World War, rationing problems. Italy was in some areas really badly damaged. And at the end of the war, quite a few more people ended up living in the caves. And the Americans saw photographs of people living in the caves. And they said, oh my God, this is dreadful. This is poor Europe. We've got to do something. And that was part of the reasoning that that General Marshall took to the US Congress that underpinned the Marshall Plan.
Wow.
The growth of the rebuilding, the biggest regeneration and rebuilding of a country that had been through war in history. And in fact, it was relevant to the whole of Western Europe, the rebuilding of Western Europe. But that was part of the evidence that the Americans took to photographs, black and white photographs of people living in the caves in Matera.
And do you think that they misunderstood?
Yes.
What was going on there?
They either misunderstood what was going on, or they deliberately decided to misunderstand what was going on.
Right.
Because, of course, the Americans were terribly anxious about the encroachment of communism from the East. And, you know, it is within regions and areas and places that are more than likely poor, where perhaps you might get fertile ground for people feeling that they want to move to that kind of government. And indeed, there are lots of villages and towns in Italy and France that are communist run.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing. But so the Americans thought, okay, we need to rebuild. We need money to do that. I've got to go to Congress to get the money, and here's the proof. You can't have them living in caves. They will be prey to communism. So I think there was a bit of creative use of those photographs, really.
And what did you think of sleeping in the cave dwelling yourself?
It was a bit freaky.
Were there any windows? I couldn't really see.
There were no windows because it's underground.
Yeah.
Underground.
I mean, sort of bit. Yeah. I wondered if there was one right at the top.
What you had at the top was like a little slit where you could see the pavement above.
The pavement.
Yeah, you could see.
Right.
So people were actually walking on top of the room, effectively.
Yeah.
And there was a little slit. I don't remember a wind, a sort of open view that you had up there of any size. I remember a little slit. But that was it. It was interesting. It was very, very interesting.
Moving on to chapter 3, that is the place where you learnt the most about yourself.
Yeah, the place where I learned the most. I think it might be Tokyo. Tokyo was my first posting as a foreign correspondent, 1996. I lived there for 2 years. And it made me realize that this was what I actually wanted to do as a foreign correspondent, which was travel and see different. And while you can have those sort of ideas and thoughts as a kid and as a teenager, you know, at some point the sort of rubber's got to hit the road type thing. And it could well be that you experience it or you try to do it and then you realize, actually, I don't like this at all. But I realized that I loved just finding out about different people, different cultures, different ideas and thoughts and sensibilities. The more alien to my own, the better. Mm. And you can't get more different than Japan in lots of ways.
Japan is probably the most mentioned destination on the podcast, either as all-time favorite destination or destination at the top of the travel bucket list. It is just, you know, so popular.
All right.
But having actually lived there is a different thing altogether.
Yeah.
So for all the listeners and guests who are desperate to go there, clearly, what would you, you know, suggest that they do, that kind of like an insider tip, having actually, you know, put down some roots there for a while?
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely contrast town and country. So it is a very built up country in lots of ways, where you have a sort of urban settlements, they tend to be quite crowded. It's a very mountainous country. It's not very flat. And a lot of it is just uninhabitable. And Tokyo is teeming.
Yeah.
Teeming with people. But that is interesting in and of itself. You know, house sizes are much smaller and people live in tiny sort of, you know, capsule apartments and that kind of thing. But it's good to be able to contrast that kind of living with the relative space that you have out in the countryside, further north in Hokkaido. And I sort of found that contrast really quite interesting and much more extreme than you would have, say, here in the UK, you know, being in London and then going out into the country. It's a place of, it's a real place of contrasts, you know, built up urban country, fairly sort of sophisticated and international, but at the same time, very conservative, not very modish, away from younger people, perhaps, in the urban centres.
Did you find it welcoming?
Yes, I did. Intensely so. Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, how deep that goes, that friendliness, I don't know. I mean, you know, Japan, certainly up to the Second World War, had a reputation for being particularly jingoistic, militaristic. And this idea of the purity of blood was very potent. Japan didn't shut down its leper colonies until the mid-90s. Most other countries did it in the 50s, yeah, when there were drugs to control the condition. So that stigma then of you not being pure, of you not being one of them, that persisted for, you know, way longer than it should have done. So the suggestion might have been that I, as a black person, would have issues. But actually, you had a lot of black American GIs who were part of the occupation force after World War II. So actually, the Japanese got used to seeing black faces in a way that the Chinese, for instance, didn't. And the Japanese love baseball, they love basketball, yeah, and they love less so soccer. It's baseball is the sort of the Western game that they are really obsessed about. They're very good at football, actually, the Japanese. And their football team has done really well in World Cups in the past. But it's baseball, which has a lot of African-American players in the United States, obviously. But they also love jazz.
I didn't realize
there is a Blue Note Jazz Club in Tokyo. It's one of the sort of chain of Blue Note Jazz Clubs. One in New York, one in Paris, and there's one in Japan.
And they love jazz.
I'm a big jazz fan. So the idea that perhaps, you know, given that history of the purity of the race and so on, I might have problems, isn't quite right, and not what I found.
And I mean, you've undertaken innumerable, extremely dangerous assignments throughout your career. When you're covering any kind of war that is bloody, and you know, how does it work in terms of logistics and you as this foreign correspondent amidst all this other stuff going on around you? I was curious as to how you operate within it. Are all the journalists kept very separate? You know, are you protected therefore? Like, how does it work in a kind of operations sense? Or do you just have to go in and you're in amongst it? Like, how does it work?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of the journalists that cover conflicts, we all talk to each other. You know, it would be, obviously, we're all trying to get scoops and we're all trying to get, you know, different things. But at the same time, you know, basic sort of operational stuff, you sort of want to be working together, really, because if you have too many people in the sort of conflict zone, all doing all kinds of different things, then that can increase the risk of something bad happening, because the minder for this particular faction involved in the war is having to deal with so many other people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So as a result, by and large, you will stay in the hotel that has the best communications, that probably has hot water, maybe has, you know, a restaurant service or food. And that's where most journalists will gravitate to. So, for instance, in Ukraine, there are two main hotels in the center of Kyiv. And that's where all the journalists are. We're all together.
And is, are they kind of protected, therefore? Like, do you feel safe in them?
Yes. I mean, there is a sense that if you're all together, it's unlikely that one of the combatants will want to sort of shell or bomb that particular hotel.
Yeah.
Or that particular dwelling place. That would only be problematic for whoever did that. You're not a combatant, you're a journalist. You're trying to get at the truth.
Yeah.
You might have a particular view on the war because you're Russian, and you have a particular war view on the war because you're Ukrainian. But there's no reason why you should then want to stop journalists telling the story. And if you do want to stop journalists telling the story, then what is it you're hiding? What is it that's going on? So by and large, the hope is that if we're all together, we're not going to get shelled and we're not going to get bombed. We'll all have been on hostile environments courses. We'll have got a sense of what it's like to be in a conflict zone and whether or not we can handle it. You know, just the sound, the noise of air raid sirens and shells going off is disturbing. It's
does it disturb you?
Depends how close it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how loud it is. If it's off in the distance, then, you know, that's obviously easier to deal with.
I imagine that, like, for the majority of the population, if they said, right, we need you to go to Ukraine right now, you'd be feeling largely worried. Do you feel more kind of excited about the opportunity to cover something that is, you know, huge?
Yes. You feel excitement. There's an adrenaline rush. It's not as potent as it would have been when I was younger. But certainly with Ukraine, I'd never been there before.
Yeah.
And that just took me straight back to my experience in Japan, you know, realizing that this was the kind of thing that I want.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
To sort of go to different interesting places. And that was a big reason why I ended up going to Ukraine. I'd just never been there before. I wanted to see what it was like. That was that. And I ended up, I thought I'd be there for 3-4 days. I ended up being there for 3 weeks.
Chapter 4 is your all-time favourite destination.
Well, that is, that's an unfair question.
Because you've been to over 80 countries just in a professional capacity.
Just in a professional capacity, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to push you to pick one.
I mean, there are places within places. There are places within countries that are amazing. So the West Coast of America is incredibly beautiful and wonderful.
You lived there for a time?
I lived in Los Angeles, I lived in Los Angeles for quite a while. And the East Coast, the northern, eastern East Coast, you know, Maine, Vermont, Maryland, is amazing too and really beautiful. I love Japan, absolutely love Japan. There is nowhere more beautiful, I think, than the English home counties in the summer. Mm-hmm. And I adore France and Italy and parts of Spain. So it's hard. Yeah, I mean, but if I had to choose, Cape Town is beautiful as well. If I had to choose, I suppose I could get away with Italy. I could get away with Venice, actually. Florence. Okay, Italy. There.
You made it.
It took a while.
And I can't say that I'm that surprised either. I didn't think it would be that hard to get to Italy.
Well, no, because you've sort of beaten me into submission in having to find somewhere.
I mean, you are professionally always doing things that push you out of your comfort zone. This you could view as, you know, a rather pleasant and relaxing jaunt through Italy. But was there anything on this Italian trip that pushed you out of your comfort zone, would you say?
Yeah, loads of it. Have you ever tried to steer a gondolier?
I absolutely have not, no. And I can't imagine it's very easy.
It was hard. It was really hard.
Testing your core strength to the max.
That's right. Absolutely. Just keeping your balance. And that was really, really difficult, actually. Really
with
difficult.
Cameras on you as well.
Yeah, with the director and the producer sincerely hoping you fall in.
Yeah, much
because
better
that's
TV.
Great telly. That's great telly. But I was determined not to fall in, and I didn't. But that was only because I was gripping to the oar for dear life. And I had the guy who was actually doing the steering, as it were, very close by.
It's not something that is top of my travel list, I don't think.
No.
Chapter 5, Clive, is your hidden gem. That is a place that you love that my listeners might not know so much about.
I love Washington, D.C., the history, the monuments, the galleries. But I also love the architecture of Georgetown.
Mm.
That sort of Federalist Georgian look, which is very symmetrical, which is partly why I like Italy. Very Palladian. It's very, very symmetrical. It's very ordered. It's very straightforward and understandable. It's not sort of, you know, all over the place and weird curves and stuff. And I love that, and the different colours, different buildings being painted different colours. It's got some great restaurants.
Yeah, I've heard it's got an amazing food scene.
It has. I mean, it was a while since I lived there, but I do remember a wonderful Ethiopian restaurant on M Street, which was just down from the BBC Bureau, which was wonderful, and great Italians too. Great Italian restaurants. But it's a city that sort of, for me, feels very sort of complete. It's not just the center of the world in terms of foreign policy. So it feels like you're somewhere substantial.
Mm.
It's you can walk around it. It's quite small. It's only about, in the at the core, about 700,000 people.
Yeah.
It's beautiful to look at. And as I say, it is, it's full of wonderful galleries and wonderful places where, you know, you can get lost for quite a few hours.
Yeah.
So
I think
yeah,
that's a great recommendation. And I mean, speaking of DC and high profile interviews, of which you've had many, I imagine, there over the years, you know, which perhaps sticks out in your mind there?
You know, I've been in the same room as Obama and Bush and Clinton, where they've been giving speeches, and you do feel that sense of American power. I mean, that aura is there with those leaders. Curiously, it isn't there with Trump. And it isn't there with Trump, I think, because he has so much baggage that he brought to the table before he became president that defined him as a human being and defined who he was,
yes,
which meant that the office couldn't define him. Of the presidency,
yeah.
And I went to one of his rallies, and it was just a bloke on a stage speaking, as opposed to someone of import speaking. It felt to me anyway, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how far we can. Well, you'll have to tell me in terms of what we can talk about, and in terms of impartiality and things, so feel free to stop me. But I mean, those leaders that you mention, they strike me as, you know, it's kind of charismatic politics in a way, in that they, as well as...
Oh, Trump is incredibly charismatic. I mean, no question.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But it's there's no question about that. And that's why, I mean, you know, in the last election, 70 million Americans voted for him.
Yeah.
So he has charisma. It's not about charisma. And in fact, I was going to say there's probably less charisma with George W. Bush than there is with Trump. But actually, George W. Bush was charismatic in his own way, to be honest with you. It was, I suppose...
A distinction between like gravitas and charisma.
I think that's what it is. I think it's gravitas.
Yeah.
I think it's a sense that this particular person is on top of it, whatever it is, when it comes to how the world operates and how the world works. And you just didn't get the sense that Trump was on top of it. You know, that it wasn't about policy and it wasn't about ideas. It felt like it was all about him. It felt a lot smaller and thinner and reedier. His sense of how the world should work.
Yeah.
It felt as if it was about him and not a grand vision, which is what you'd want the leader of the free world to have, which is essentially what they are, American
presidents. But speaking about being on top of it, like then here in the UK, more in recent times politically, have you felt that the leaders of our country have been on top of it?
COVID was hard for everybody, every single world leader. The economic financial crash was hard for everyone, no question. This is regardless of political stripe. And, you know, dealing with European war, the first of any major scale since World War II, is difficult for anyone to have to deal with as well. So, I mean, I'm being cagey here for those impartiality reasons, but I think it hasn't been an easy time. And it is in those difficult times that you find out how good your governing or political class is. But I think globally, there's been a lot that hasn't worked. And I don't know if that is a reflection on the quality of our leaders globally, or whether the problems have just been too big for those leaders to have to
manage, to
deal with.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we've been left wanting on a whole manner of fronts.
Well, Clive, our penultimate chapter is your worst travel experience, chapter 6.
worst travel experience. Most of my worst travel experiences have involved war zones, getting in, but most of the time getting out. And usually because there's something else that I need to do, like see my family and get home by Christmas. I mean, I remember having real difficulty getting out of Afghanistan Christmas time. I was in Tora Bora, and the Americans, the coalition, thought they'd cornered Osama bin Laden in this mountainous area between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And they had B-52 bombers, huge great things, that were just bombing the hell out of this area. And I was covering the story there. But get it, I mean, it was, I don't know, 6-7 hour drive to get to this mountainous area, and then 6-7 hours, you're sleeping in tents and all this kind of stuff. And it was right up to Christmas, and I really wanted to get home for Christmas. And it was really hard getting out, and really difficult getting out.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to get out of Iraq, to get to Oman, to get a flight, to get back home. I remember we got stuck by sandstorms, and it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible.
And more recently in Ukraine, you had this terrible car accident.
Yeah, that was, well, that was, I wasn't trying to leave. That was just a blowout, tire blowout. Yeah. That was just bad luck. Just tire just blew. And it rolled over four times.
Yeah. Was that the kind of most kind of near miss you've had, would you say?
Yeah. Yes, I think so. I remember as it rolled over, just thinking, and it rolled over four times because I don't remember this. But it rolled four times, apparently, because the security vehicle that we had behind us saw it roll four times. I don't remember it rolling, in fact. All that seems to have gone out of my head. I just remember thinking, I've just got to protect my head, stop it hitting the roof of the vehicle. But now I was in Afghanistan in the late 90s. The Taliban had taken over. It was Ramadan had just come to an end. And I was in a coffee shop, breakfast place. Taliban fighter came in, he wanted two eggs. Loads of people had got in there before him. Fasting had ended because Ramadan was over. It was Eid. And the guy behind the counter said, we haven't got any eggs. And he took his Kalashnikov out and he said, I'm going to kill everyone in this restaurant, in this place, if you don't get me two eggs, because I am absolutely starving. And if you don't eat, you're irritable. And he was irritable. And he was the law. The Taliban were the law. They could do whatever they liked. So there would be no problem. I mean, I hid behind a pillar because I thought he was going to just spray everywhere with AK bullets.
Oh, my God.
And the guy behind the counter, he produced two eggs.
Oh, my gosh. Thank God for that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So before the vehicle rolled four times, that was the closest I thought, oh, my God.
Yeah.
This guy's just going to lose it. And as I say, the thing
And really, you know, for eggs at the end of the day, that wouldn't have been...
For food in his belly.
Yeah.
So to die for two eggs, a couple of omelets, scrambled eggs, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, that's
weird. We could be forever grateful that they found some eggs in the back of the pantry in that restaurant.
They did a lot of searching and they found the eggs.
Clive, I honestly could chat to you for the rest of the day. I mean, it has been so fascinating. And thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We're on the final chapter of your travel diaries, chapter 7. And that is the destination at the top of your travel bucket list.
The place that I would love to go to is St. Petersburg. I've seen a lot. I've heard a lot. I love to go to Moscow as well. Russia, basically. And I'm now banned.
Forever? Would you ever feel safe going there now, do you think?
Not while Putin was in power, no. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And if I set foot in there and I got and I was stopped, I would be done on spying charges, I'm sure. That's the one place on earth I would love to go. I really wanted to go to Sri Lanka. I'd never been to Sri Lanka, and I was there maybe 4 or 5 years ago, covering the attack on a church there by Islamic extremists. So I went under horrible circumstances, but I managed to see a little bit of the place. But no, it would be Russia. It would be Russia, yeah. Particularly now that I have a newfound interest in Eastern Europe that I never really had. Communism always struck me as being really much sadder in colder places. So I could handle being in Vietnam or Cuba or Angola. But, you know, Tajikistan in the middle of winter. Not great. Not great. Communism was always much more attractive in Cuba than it ever was in Belarus.
Well, on that note, Clive Murray, thank you so much. Those were your travel diaries.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Ah, huge thank you to Clive. What an interesting life he has led. Clive Myrie's Italian Road Trip. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb super host. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Trip is available on BBC iPlayer now. Get ready to be transported to that beautiful country. It's a fantastic watch. Thanks so much for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to press follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you want to be the first to find out who's joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'd love to hear from you. I'm at Holly Rubenstein, and you'll also find me on Twitter and TikTok, as of a few weeks ago, also at Holly Rubenstein. And if you can't wait until then, remember there's the first 8 seasons to catch up on. That's over 90 episodes to keep you busy there. All the destinations mentioned by my guests are included in the episode show notes here on your podcast app and listed on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks, everyone, and I'll be back next week.